This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy.
In a nation as rich as ours, it is a shocking fact that tens of millions lack adequate medical care.
That's Harry Truman in his State of the Union address to Congress in 1949. He had just been reelected. Maybe that's why he decided to drag out this old agenda item that so far had gone absolutely nowhere.
Moreover, we need and we must have, without further delay, a system of prepaid medical insurance which will enable every American to afford good medical care.
And needless to say, we did have further delay, 60 years of it, in fact, and still counting. And it's not for lack of trying. Truman may have been the first president with a concrete proposal for universal health insurance, but there have been plenty more since then. Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and most recently, Bill Clinton. So can President Obama accomplish now what so many other presidents have failed to do?
On each episode of Backstory, we pluck a topic from the headlines and spend an hour exploring its history. Today, that topic is healthcare. How has the debate played out since Truman, and what did it look like before him? Was access to healthcare such a major issue before the age of modern medicine?
When we started fielding healthcare questions on our website a few weeks ago, it quickly became apparent that there was one question that was on everybody's minds. It was summed up nicely in this voicemail from a listener in Ohio.
Hi, this is Bruce Weingart. I'm calling from Columbus, Ohio. I have a question regarding how is it that the American approach to healthcare differs so from the European model? Where did we go on a different route?
So I guess the real question is, when did American and European systems of healthcare diverge? Did that happen back in ye olde times, Peter?
Well, Ed, I think using the word system is overdoing it a little bit for the colonial period. And basically, as you know, there are no public institutions to speak of. It's only in colonial cities that you have poorhouses and jails and eventually a hospital in Philadelphia in 1751. But that's unusual. Most colonial Americans deal with issues of life and death within the family.
Would that have been very different back in Europe?
No, honestly. The big difference is a question of scale. It's when you have a large number of people in a big city, they're often not connected with each other, so the family form simply doesn't exist. And there are institutions that make up for the failure of families, but that's not healthcare. It's more getting dead bodies out of the way, burying them. Well, that's pretty brutal.
What a way to open our show.
Well, in the 19th century, you know, you would think that maybe there were great advances in technology.
Yeah, which ones would those be?
But there weren't, really. Not until the very end of the 19th century, which comes perilously close to edging into Brian's territory.
Yeah, so should we just give the whole show up to Brian? What do you say?
Well, you know, I was trying to kill as much time as possible by talking about things that didn't happen in our centuries.
You mean I actually get to answer a question? This could be a first on Backstory.
Yeah, yeah, go for
it's
it.
It's too bad you wasted part of your time talking about how you finally get to answer one.
Yeah, and now I got to waste more of it because, in fact, I want to turn to this other guy who's going to answer part of that question first.
My name is Jacob Hacker. I'm a professor of political science at Yale University.
I should tell you right now that this Jacob Hacker, he's not just any political scientist. This is the guy who, as a grad student 10 years ago, basically created the blueprint for this public option that we've been hearing so much about. So it's clear where he stands in the legislative debate. But still, I thought it would be interesting to get his take on some of the history. So I put our caller's question to him.
Well, there's a couple answers to that question. The political scientist in me will say this is a reflection of our fragmented political institutions and our anti-government political culture. That's sort of one class of explanations.
Hold out. Time out, Mr. Political Scientist.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you mean by fragmented institutions? In radio talk, what is that?
Well, in radio talk, it's the checks and balances that our Constitution creates that make it so hard to pass integrated, comprehensive programs.
I mean, so different branches of government.
Different branches of government, federalism with states in the federal government with overlapping responsibilities.
Uh-huh.
There's been scores of Europeans who have come over to the United States and sniffed at the American state and said it doesn't really constitute a state at all because it is so messy. And it is generally very hard to pass big legislative initiatives.
So that's the political science view on all of this. It wasn't simply doctors or drug companies who were opposed to reform. And it wasn't just the big bad insurance companies either. Hacker says that all those business interests wouldn't have had the impact they had if it weren't for our decentralized model of government.
But I think it's really important to understand that every time that we failed in the past to enact reform, a new set of vested interests have emerged. And just as important, we've seen the development of a massive system of private health insurance that covers the vast majority of working Americans. So to me, that's the big story, that the choices we made in the past have sent us down a path that's very hard to get off of.
Health reform on the national level first went down for defeat during the Progressive Era back in 1912. That was the year that Teddy Roosevelt ran unsuccessfully for a third term as president on a populist platform that included compulsory sickness insurance that would cover people's wages while they were sick and out of work. The fight then moved to the state level, and reformers came close to winning in both New York and California. But this was just about the time that doctors were really beginning to feel their oats and organize, and medical care was getting more expensive. It didn't take those doctors long to figure out that healthcare reform might directly affect their livelihoods. And then there were these brand new insurance companies. Here's Hacker again.
Perhaps the most interesting story from this period is the story of Frederick Hoffman, who worked for Prudential. He was an actuary. You know, actuaries are definitely a rabble-rousing bunch. In any case, he turned out to be one. He probably was the leading propagandist against any of these efforts. He said that there would be rationing of care, that government would come between patients and their doctors.
Right.
He said that this was imported from Germany. It was a socialist plot. He said that it would be allowing immigrants to receive care, that it would be helping the less well-bred stock of the nation and hurting the genetically pure. I mean, it was a panoply of fabrications and incendiary lies that bears, I'm sorry to say, more than a passing resemblance to some of the invective that has been hurled against healthcare reform this time around. And I think it's worth remembering, every time we've had a debate over this issue, it has become a very emotional debate very quickly.
That highly charged history probably goes a long way towards explaining why Franklin Roosevelt decided to drop national health insurance from his New Deal legislation in the mid-30s. He had plenty on his plate already with Social Security and unemployment insurance, but still, it's a decision that pains Jacob Hacker even today.
He had a remarkable political position, right? He comes into office during the worst economic downturn in the nation's history. He has a mandate to act. He has huge Democratic majorities. Mm-hmm. My read of the history and a lot of other people's read of the history is that had Roosevelt insisted on including some kind of health insurance provision in the Social Security Act, it probably would have passed.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't for two reasons, one of which is the doctors were completely
right
opposed. And he was.
And we should just pause and say that, you know, these were big men around town, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, they were pretty influential in their local communities.
Absolutely.
And congressional districts.
Yeah, they had all these state chapters and local chapters. And plus, you know, whenever you went to your doctor, they would tell you whether or not it was a good or bad thing to have this happen. So.
And you know what else? We actually believed in experts in those days.
We
thought they were the good guys.
No, right. I mean, why else would the tobacco companies have had, you know, doctors touting Camel cigarettes?
Yeah.
You know, because if your doctor smokes, that must be good for you.
Yeah.
Any case, the second thing is that Roosevelt believed that he could just come back and do this a few years later.
Right.
And that was sort of the first and the last, in a sense, time that putting it off was final.
Why was FDR our last chance, as you see it, up till now?
I think FDR was our last chance because of the fact that when reform went down to defeat in 1935 or never even got a chance to be considered, that was really a turning point in the development of private health insurance. I mean, it's hard to remember today when people are losing coverage right and left just how quickly
right.
health insurance expanded during and after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Cross plans, hospital plans, emerged in the midst of the Depression. And by the end of World War II, we're talking about coverage that's probably reaching something like half of the American population. And so the typical blue-collar worker before World War II didn't have health insurance coverage. The typical blue-collar worker after World War II had pretty generous private health insurance. For that worker, suddenly the prospect of a tax-funded national health insurance program is just a lot less attractive. So what I think is important to understand is that it wasn't just, you know, private insurance companies or drug companies or businesses that benefited from relying on private health insurance, at least initially, but also that lots of Americans saw private health insurance as a good solution for them.
That's Jacob Hacker, political science professor at Yale University and the original author of the so-called Public Option Plan for Government-Sponsored Health Insurance.
So the train of health care reform doesn't stop in the Progressive Era, doesn't stop in the New Deal, barely pauses in the post-World War II era, slows down long enough to pick up the very poorest of Medicare and Medicaid in the 1960s. But what happens in the 70s and 80s? Does the idea just completely go underground, or are people fighting for it, or what?
No, it doesn't go underground. And I love your metaphor of the train of healthcare reform, but running on a separate track and ultimately heading for a collision after it gains enough momentum is another train, and that's the train of healthcare provision. And it is stopping at every local stop, picking up those employer-based healthcare folks, picking up a huge number of passengers through the Veterans Administration, picking up folks through Blue Cross and Blue Shield who are self-employed.
And so, Brian, would you say then that the actual tipping point that led to the current debate was that the train is beginning to empty out?
Yes.
A lot of people aren't getting on.
Absolutely. I'd say the train is derailed, Peter. We don't have to look at this incrementally.
Right.
Look, every time we run into a recession, we shed jobs, and with those jobs goes health care. But what's more, starting with Nixon, this country started shedding manufacturing jobs. Jobs started going overseas. And what did employers do to become more competitive and cut costs? They started cutting their health care benefits. So more and more jobs don't come with health care benefits. And that is the train wreck.
We're back with Backstory, the show that looks to the past to explain the America of today. I'm Peter Onuf, your guide to the 18th century.
I'm Ed Ayers, your guide to the 19th century.
And I'm Brian Ballow, guide to the 20th century. We're talking today about the history of healthcare in America. In the first part of the show, we focused on my century and some of the background of the debate taking place now in Washington. But now it's time for some deep history. And when I say deep, I'm not talking about the 19th century, Ed. I'm not even talking about the 18th century. No, we are going all the way back to the 17th century. God, I didn't know I could
do that.
I didn't know I could count that low.
When we think of hospitals today, we think of sick people. But back in medieval Europe, that's even before the 17th century, hospitals took in pilgrims, travelers, and strangers, anybody in need with no place else to go. It's no coincidence that hospital sounds a lot like hospitality. Both share the Latin root hospes, meaning host, guest, or stranger. And so for hundreds of years, the word hospital was used interchangeably with guest house. Such was the case in the early 1600s when English colonists established North America's first hospital right here in Virginia. Backstory producer Catherine Moore has the story.
So you've heard of Jamestown, but you might not have heard of Henricus, the second English settlement in the New World. By 1611, it's turning out that swampy, mosquito-infested Jamestown isn't the healthiest place to make a new world, so the Virginia Company's deputy governor, a military man named Sir Thomas Dale, sets his sights on a more secure spot, with fresher air. Across the river from the new town, he builds a string of forts, one of which also serves as a place for sick people.
We are in the recreation of Mount Mulado, which was the first English hospital, or guest house, built here in the New World.
I'm standing inside a large Waddell and Dobbs style building. As my eyes adjust to the darkness, I see a few dozen primitive beds and tables covered with ominous-looking medical instruments, herbs, and suspicious powders. My tour guide is John Pagano, an interpreter at Henricus Historical Park, who dresses as one of Sir Thomas Dale's soldiers. It was these soldiers who provided most of the care for the guests at Mount Mulato.
It's part of your agreement, your indenture with the Virginia Company of London, that they'll care for you when you're ill. They'll provide food, clothing, shelter, all of it.
The Virginia Company, of course, had an interest in keeping its workers healthy and in showing folks back home that the new world was worth the trip. But John tells me there was also a larger vision at work.
Sir Thomas Dale is going to name this area the Commonwealth because Dale believes that everyone, whether you're wealthy or whether you're here as an indenture and you're from a poor family, that everybody here pitches into everyone else's work and everyone will prosper. He probably, if he would have continued that thought into all areas of settlement, he might have called the medical practices here in the hospitals the common health, because no matter what class you were, you get the same treatment as everyone else.
Sounds pretty nice, huh? Well, yeah, until you consider the kind of medical treatment that was so liberally dispensed across class lines.
There is a surgeon or two in the colony, but they're essentially traveling surgeons, or what they called back then barber surgeons. They can cut your hair and treat your illnesses all at the same time, but they don't really have a lot to go on. So they'll just go in there, and they'll cut around things, pull things out and look at them. And in this time period, there's no anesthesia. So this isn't a time period where you want them to go internally into you.
Especially when the barber surgeon is stuck downriver and all you get is a soldier with a bone saw. You can understand why people might have been a bit hesitant to check into this guest house. After all, they came from a world where the sick were cared for by women at home.
The common people back then would have just been touching on this idea of going to some place and letting someone else care for my mother or my son. And if you think about people today, would anyone go into a strange house and have someone who has no medical training work on them?
So how would they have gone about trying to convince people that this was safe or the best way to get the care that they needed?
It's essentially a loaded answer because like a lot of things under Sir Thomas Dale, we're going to tell you what to do and you're going to learn to like it because we're the ones in charge. And although you don't understand the wisdom in why the Virginia Company of London has this, I do.
So before you get all misty-eyed about common health and commonwealth, just remember that back then, healthcare was enforced at the end of a stick. So it's little surprise that as business in the new world starts to pick up and martial law is relaxed, Mount Mulato becomes a thing of the past. By 1622, Thomas Dale is gone. He succumbed to the bloody flux in India, and the building has been bought by an ironmonger, who probably used it to house his workers. And we don't see another public hospital in America for over 100 years. In the meantime, there were a few almshouses for the poor, pest houses for serious epidemics, and itinerant doctors for the very wealthy. But most importantly, there were more families. Early Americans looked after their own. Only strangers to a new world needed other strangers to take care of them.
That's Backstory producer Catherine Moore. You can see pictures of the hospital at Henricus at our website, backstoryradio.org.
So now we're going to jump ahead in time 100 years and travel up the East Coast to Boston. In April of 1721, some sailors stepped off a ship from the West Indies there with a disease no one had seen in the area for 20 years, smallpox. One of the sailors was quarantined instantly, but a couple others went into town and behaved well, like sailors behave when they're on leave. The disease spread like wildfire, and soon the people of Boston began dying. Reporter Nate DeMeo is going to pick up the story from here.
It felt like the flu. You'd get a fever and chills. You'd feel achy. Sometimes you'd throw up. Sometimes you wouldn't. And then the rash would start to appear. And you would know you were probably going to die. In the summer of 1721, nearly half of Boston's 11,000 people came down with smallpox. Every other Bostonian, every other wheelwright and cooper, every other brewer and printer and clergyman. And when they got it, they either died or were permanently disfigured. Those were your options. And the people of Boston were terrified. Which of their loved ones would be next? Which of their customers or employees would stop showing up? would their father make it through the night? And who could they blame? This was the Puritan city, so of course there was Satan. There was always Satan. But a lot of Bostonians blamed themselves. They had allowed their city to become a den of sin. They had profited from the booming trade that was flowing in and out of it, that brought in foreign heathens and rum and tobacco, and now this pox. This was God's will. The city should sit and take its punishment and let the disease run its course. Nearly every Bostonian believed it. Nearly every doctor and clergyman believed it. But two did not. No one in the New World deserved more credit or more blame for making people believe it than the Reverend Cotton Mather. Since graduating from Harvard at 15, he had written theological treatises that had defined the Puritans to themselves. He had written on the wages of sin, on the ways of demons and witches. He helped infuse the fanatics of Salem with the beliefs that drove them to persecute and kill their neighbors. But this man of God was also a man of science. Mather had heard years before about the practice of inoculation. A slave had told him about how back in Africa, they would take needles and remove pus from the wounds and sores of infected people and poke it into the skin of healthy ones. The healthy people would get sick, but for a brief time, and they wouldn't die. Now, with smallpox spreading fear and death in his city, Mather wanted to try the heathen science. His city wasn't having any of it. His fellow clergymen condemned him for heresy. Doctors condemned him too. I mean, no doctor would sicken someone intentionally. It was against the whole point of being a doctor. Mather showed them accounts of the Chinese doing it, of Turks doing it, but he couldn't convince them. The procedure was forbidden before it could even be attempted. But one doctor decided Mather was right. His name, his delightfully preposterous ye olde New England name, was Zabdiel Boylston. And he was just as frightened as anyone else. He had been helpless, watching his patients die, seeing faces he'd loved become scarred and barely recognizable. On September 21st, he took a needle and scraped pus from the open sores of an infected man. And he took that needle, covered in this stuff that, even in this time, long before people understood what germs were, he had to know that stuff was filled with disease. He took that needle in one hand, and with his other hand, he took his 6-year-old son, held him tightly, and stabbed the needle into the boy's arm. Later that day, he did the same to his slave, and the slave's own young son. The city exploded. Ministers, doctors, and pamphleteers condemned the two men. They said Zabdiel Boylston was killing his son, that even by simply attempting to fend off the disease, he was defying God. A firebomb crashed through Mather's window. Boylston can leave his house, even after his son and his slave and that man's son got better. Even as other people, refusing to sit and wait to die, sneaked into the doctor's home and demanded to be inoculated. Even as word spread that their procedure seemed to be working. Everyone condemned the doctor and the reverend. Later that fall, when the smallpox epidemic had finally run its course, people could finally look at the numbers. Nearly half of the city had contracted the disease. Of those who had, nearly 1 in 6 had died. Of the 244 people Boylston inoculated, 6 people died. That's only 1 in 40. And still for years, much of Boston condemned Mather and Boylston. Even after the next year when the British royal family essentially risked everything and inoculated the young heirs to the throne. Even after Boylston himself traveled to London to be inducted into its royal society. And even after he returned to Boston to live and to outlive just about everyone, dying peacefully at the age of 90.
That's Nate DeMayo. You can listen to more of his evocative tales about the dark corners of American history at his website, thememorypalace, all one word, .us. And you can find his podcast, along with ours, in the history section of the iTunes store.
Well, Ed, I thought those were a couple of interesting features. And they do point to something I think is really important for the larger show that we're doing today. And that has to do with the way in the early period, in my period, the 17th and 18th century, that leaders of the community had to address public health issues, dangers to the health of the entire community. When they were attacked by smallpox, it was something like being attacked by a foreign enemy. So that idea that we consider the health of the people in the context of the fate of the Commonwealth, politics, economy, and society are all so closely linked. It's not the kind of focus on the individual and the health of the individual that's characteristic today.
So was this the beginning of public health in America?
Oh, yeah. I think that's fair to say. And that is collective strategies are necessary. And one of the reasons for this is that the prospects of dying are much greater than they are now. And I think that's the single fact we have to keep in mind. Women were prone to die in childbirth. I mean, they called really old people in New England like 70 years old or even 60 years old. They were revered almost as angels. They were special people because somehow God intended them to survive. In other words, the normal expectation is death. And that means that you can't rely on families alone. Families have to be knit to other families and to a broader sense of commonwealth.
Well, as we do with each episode of the show, we've been fielding comments on today's topic at backstoryradio.org. And our producers have invited a few of the folks who've left comments there to join us on the phone now.
We got a call. It's Kathy from Athol, Massachusetts.
Hi.
Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
We're talking about healthcare today, and it's on everybody's mind, and you've got a question.
I do. I've been wondering whether when government got into other things that we now think of as public sectors, like public safety or public education, or, and I know there have been debates about public utilities back and forth, but I'm just wondering whether the healthcare debate is actually sort of in a class by itself in terms of the kind of fear and anxiety that it seems to provoke in people about the role of the government getting into, you know, this sort of intimate realm of life, or whether it's really part of a kind of a long sequence of fights that are essentially over the same thing.
Well, my reflex reaction, and that's about what I'm good for, is to suggest that that anti-statism and that hostility to the public sector has become a major ideological strain in American history, and it's been present from the founding. It takes different forms, but the fear of gun control or fluoridating water supply or whatever it might be.
Or taxes.
Yeah, taxes. Just about anything.
On tea.
Brian, do you think this is the case in the 20th century?
I would say that, yes, anti-statism has been with us and is distinguishes us from other countries like Canada that are used to stronger forms of executive government going way, way back. But I think what Americans particularly dislike and fear is any kind of bureaucracy, or back in Ed and Peter's day, functionaries, kind of that administration, officials telling them what to do. Now, why they don't think insurance company functionaries are bureaucrats who are controlling their medical care, it's a mystery to me, except as an historian, I know that Americans have always distinguished between the two. You know, Americans spend a ton of money, public money, on healthcare, but they do it by giving private employers tax breaks, and in fact, by giving employees tax breaks for the benefits that they get. We spend hundreds of billions of dollars each year on that, almost as much as Medicare. But there's no visible government bureaucrat sitting there.
I think it's a really interesting point that you've just made, and it's interesting that people seem so strongly resistant to having someone tell them what to do when profit is not the main motive, but they don't seem to mind it as much when profit is the motive. Maybe that's because it sort of lets us still feel as though the free market is keeping us free.
Yes, I think that's right. We're assuming that the invisible hand is somehow making sure that, I know it seems very expensive to have, you know, $80,000 for this toenail removal, but it must be the market, so therefore it's okay, you know? You know? But, you know, to go back to your original question, is there something special about healthcare? And I think there is, and I think there's two currents that are joining that are making the current debate so livid. One, anything that deals with the body
and you raised the issue of intimacy, is very powerful. Peter had mentioned fluoridation, and it's hard for us to imagine what a prolonged and fervent debate that was in the 1950s about sort of the infiltration of our bodies by this chemical that's being put in the water, and the communists wanted us to do that. But also, of course, the abortion debate, and you think about what the bumper stickers and things are about that, you know, keep your laws off my body, and both sides of these kinds of things. And healthcare itself is the entire range of everything touching your body. And so I think that there is something specially alarming to some people about the idea of the government touching your body. And now, why the government? Well, my dad used to have a saying when we were out, you know, planting a tree or doing some work around the yard, and he'd say, well, we're done. That's good enough for government work. And, you know, and that would be just a joke, you know, that it was, you know, okay, we kind of did it halfway the way that the government would do it. You know, we imagine, you know, the invocation, and I say this with full respect for anybody involved in motor vehicle registration, DMV and healthcare is the image that Americans have at all this. So it's the inefficiency they imagine of the government combined with the invasiveness of touching your body that I think just drives people crazy about this.
Kathy, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I hope we were good enough for government, Kathy.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's time for another short break. When we get back, we'll take more of your calls about the history of healthcare in America.
Remember, if you'd like to join us with a question on a future show, have a look at our website to see the topics we're working on. We're at backstoryradio.org.
Underwriting support for Backstory comes from the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, committed to the idea that the future may learn from the past.